Let me say a few words about the Shiur tonight. Tonight I'm going to try to gain an insight in the events which are described in the Megillah, in Megillah Esther. I'm mainly concerned with the human role in history as reflected by Megillah Esther, and I'm also concerned with the distinctive roles which men and women, male and female, play in the historical drama. In order to achieve this objective, I'll have to interpret certain passages in the Megillah. What I'm going to say will be very simple, even though very long. The Megillah contains the story of events which occurred at the twilight hour in Jewish history. It marks the passing of a bright, beautiful summer day, full of song and color and joy. A day on which God's word was on many tongues and His Spirit in many hearts. It marks the passing of the summer day. It also marks the approaching of a dark, dreary, autumnal night of silence and fear. A night in the course of which God stopped speaking to His people. The covenantal community at that hour of twilight was losing, slowly but surely, the most precious of all its gifts, namely prophecy. The great covenantal dialogue between man and God, which commenced with Abraham, was about to be terminated. And the prophetic community faced a stark and ruthless reality, a non-prophetic existence, for which the Jew was not prepared for. Of course, with the transition from a prophetic to a non-prophetic community, the Jewish historical experience changed considerably. The events which were recorded in the Megillah are differently arranged already and differently interconnected than, let us say, the events surrounding Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, as reported in the Book of Exodus. These two sets of events, the set of events of Egypt and the set of events of Shushana Biro, differ in two respects. First, as regards the theology and causal nexus. While the Megillah occurrences fit perfectly into the framework of normal historical causality, the occurrences in Egypt preceding the Exodus belong to a meta-historical, indeed metaphysical order of things and events. It's number one. a different causality, a different etiology, it's two different frames of reference. Second, the role of man as assumed with the emergence of the non-prophetic community, new dimensions. To be sure, in both epochs, God used man as the instrument of implementation. Man has always been the so-called, it's a Maimonidean expression, Shliach Hokeil, the messenger of God, God's plenipotentiary, or ambassador on earth. Mordecai himself proclaimed this doctrine that man is the Shliach Hokeil in his famous message he sent to Esther, Vinatan, Nevertheless, there is a basic discrepancy between the shlichus entrusted to Moses and that assigned to Mordechai. The mission with which Moses was charged was precisely defined. There was no alternative but to act in a strictly prescribed manner. Moses did not enjoy the freedom of decision and action. He received specific instructions what to do and how to act. Take just an example. Daber Bnei Yisrael Leizor. Ve'ato Remes Matcho Halayom. Tnu lochem, tnu usu lochem, sofeino, etc., etc. In contrast to this kind of shliches, Mordechai received not a clearly defined, but multifaceted mandate. It was left to him how to interpret and implement this mandate. Mordecai was confronted with a number of alternatives. The choice was his. He exercised free judgment and free evaluation. In Egypt, God acted, basically. Man was an onlooker. We all say in the Rabbinic treatise, Meishu was the shaliach, the messenger, but his role was confined in Egypt to a mechanical performance. In Persia, and this is typical of the entire era of non-prophetic Judaism, God summoned men to act. He gave him a mandate to act, but he did not define or formulate the mandate. He told men to act freely and wisely, of course, under God's supervision and a watchful eye. What men enjoyed and still enjoy, true freedom. Of course, God is in communication with man in both eras, in the prophetic as well as in the non-prophetic era. However, the nature of the communication is not the same. In the prophetic era, as I said before, the communication was clear and understandable. While in the non-prophetic era, the communication, the divine communications which reached man were very laconic and enigmatic, consisting of mysterious hints and signs, bright dazzling flashes and intimations that mystified man. The latter quite often In the non-prophetic era, when freedom of action was granted him, felt very lonely and forsaken. Man in the non-prophetic era is from time to time, erroneously, under the impression as if God has abandoned and deserted him. A frightening silence envelops everybody and everything in the non-prophetic era. There is a very strange passage, a unique passage, in whom the Talmud asked a very strange question. Esther minatero minai. Where is the name of Esther mentioned in the Pentateuch? Strange question. And the answer was given immediately. It is mentioned, indeed. Well, was it mentioned? Ve'onechi Esther Esther ponai by Yomahu. And I shall hide my countenance on that day of silence. What did the Talmud mean to express by this question and this answer? I believe a very simple thought. The Pentateuch tells us the story of the prophetic community, of course. All five books tell us the story of the prophetic community, at the hour of triumph, at the hour of universal revelation and direct contact with God. The Pentateuch tells us the story of Moses and the community he led. But what kind of a message does the Pentateuch have for the non-prophetic community? At an hour not of triumph, but at an hour of defeat and distress. Where is there in the Torah an allusion to the silent, mute confrontation between mighty historical events, invincible, almost invincible historical force, and the Jew, both in the Promised Land and in the Diaspora? Where is there a hint in the Torah about the struggle between a wicked prime minister, powerful, sly, and a lonely Jewish girl, lonely Jewish poor girl, on whose frame shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility? About the struggle between a wicked prime minister, powerful, sly, and a lonely Jewish girl, lonely Jewish poor girl, on whose frame shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility. The question in the Talmud Esther Menachem Romanai is a simple one. How can the Jew triumph over his adversaries and enemies if God stopped speaking to him? If the messages he receives are quite often illegible and incomprehensible. And the answer to this question was more a statement of fact rather than an explanation. Even during the non-prophetic era, at a time when the countenance is hidden, man is elected by God to carry on, to make decisions, to undertake difficult tasks, courageously, and to implement them superbly. Of course, it's a superhuman task for a young, inexperienced girl to stand up against the powerful, wicked Prime Minister. However, the Ruhakide is the Spirit of God, who will descend on her and inspire her to defy danger and to make the right decisions. God asks us men to reach maturity and independence. He wills men to act with courage and wisdom, to be his own master. The Yom Sobei, Ashiru Adin, the song of the Torah, will never be terminated. All communities, prophetic and non-prophetic, will join in. So, Mordechai and Esther were perhaps the first representatives of a non-prophetic community, a community in the diaspora, dispersed over a large territory, which was suddenly faced with a menace of mountainous proportions. Providence selected as the Shlichei Elokeinu, and I'm going to call them like that, as the Shlichei Elokeinu, as the messengers of God, not only Mordechai, but Esther as well. God apparently willed that both male and female appear as the actors on the historical stage. He removed himself from the stage. He wanted men to take his place. Judaism has never discriminated. And I want you to know I'm not trying to somehow to find grace in the eyes of the women who lead. As a matter of fact, I didn't intend to analyze the role of Esther and that of Mordechai. But somehow I got involved, and I had to tear out my task, which was great upon my frame shoulders by that story. Judaism has never discriminated against the women. As far as history making is concerned, I'm qualifying my study. But the most important part, or the most important task assigned to man is not to be counted as the 10th person in the end, but to make history. And as far as history is concerned, Yahadus has never discriminated against the man. From the days of Sarah, the woman was on par with man as a history maker. And perhaps at certain times, at times of crisis, the woman who was contributed more than man. The third phrase in the Pentateuch, which you read every Rosh Hashanah, Shema became has never been forgotten by the Jewish community. Both Mordechai and Esther were created in the image of God, no doubt about it. Both were endowed with dignity and majesty. Both possessed great talent. Both were charismatic personae. And both were called, what I say, using colloquialism, to the color when disaster was about to strike. Both were summoned to make history. Of course, the statement that God assigns equally important roles to Mordechai. And Esther, because both of them were metaphysically and spiritually worthy of the job, must not be misunderstood. The assignments were equal in importance, no doubt about it. And perhaps as we'll see later, Esther's assignment transcended that of Mordecai, as far as historical significance is concerned. No doubt about it, they were equal in importance, but by no means identical. The assignments differed because there is, and I'm sorry to say that, but it is true and it is the opinion of the others. So there is a basic differentiation of the sexes, not only physiologically, but psychically, I don't say psychologically, I say psychically and spiritually as well. It cannot be denied. A historical masculine role cannot be assigned to the woman, and vice versa, a feminine task must not be imposed upon man. In spite of the distinct roles which were assigned to Mordecai and Esther, they both collaborated beautifully. They were inseparable. We always start Alanisim, the name Mordecai and Esther. Could have said the name Mordecai. As a matter of fact, the Goyen has eliminated the name Esther, but he didn't accept his opinion. We could also say, we could say the name Mordecai. No, it would be unjust and unfair. They both played, the roles of both were complementary. And when you mention one, another name should go along. Now, before I want to investigate the role of Esther and the role of Mordecai, distinct roles, but equally important, I want to just ask another question. Who actually are those Shluchei Okeil, those individuals whom God has chosen to implement His will and to act as His representatives in both eras, in the prophetic and the non-prophetic as well? Who are those charismatic personae elected by God to be history makers? And with whom, with those Shluchei Okeil, Jewish history is populated? It's a plea. From Abraham to Moses, and from Moses to Isaiah, and from Isaiah to Rabbi Akiva, and from Rabbi Akiva to Maimonides, and from Maimonides to the Ari, and from the Ari to the Baal Shem Tov, and etc., etc. Who were these cryptic figures? Who were they? These mysterious cryptic figures who played their roles so well, with determination and self-effacement, humbly and yet consistently, played the role and disappeared. Those figures, from Abraham down, have always intrigued me, always stimulated my curiosity. You are not simple people, should you say so? Just simple people? We were different. Of course, we have to say we were different. However, what we are, you, in what way different? Let us gaze at them for a while. Mordecai, just to examine Mordecai as an individual, was most probably an elderly Jew by the time those events which were recorded in Megillah occurred. He was, again, I mean, it's just a hypothetical statement on my part, he was most probably the son of a poor immigrant. He himself most probably was born in Shushan or in Persia, because Minagilo Ashahedron and Nebuchadnezzar, and don't forget it was at the close of the 70 years, so it's almost an impossibility that Mordechai was born in Israel and was exiled to Shushan and or to Babylonia, and spent 70 years there before he became prime minister to Ahasuerus. I don't believe Ahasuerus would have appointed an old Jew, I mean, to the office of prime minister. He was most probably a son of poor immigrants, poor exiles. No one knew of his existence. No one cared to know of his existence, of the Ish Yehudi. What role could the Ish Yehudi play in the capital of Persia? What kind of a role? He lived in anonymity. And yet, we read in the Megillah, of course, but to understand the Megillah, I would advise you to read the Megillah in private, not in the shul, where Homer's name, I mean, whenever you mention home, Homer, I mean, there's banging and noise making. And yet, do you read in the Megillah that when Mordechai cries, a loud and bitter cry, the Jews throughout the empire cried with him. ויזעק זוכרתי לאמרו, וחמיר לעיר, וכי משה דבר המלך ודוסי מגיע, אלו גודל היהודים, וכי נבחי ומשפט. שושן was perplexed and in despair. Then Mordechai cried, ויהיה שושן רעיכו. On the contrary, the Megillah tells us that when Mordechai suddenly appeared to the surprise of everybody, on the streets of Shushan, clothed in purple and velvet, with a crown of gold on his head, the whole city was delirious with joy. When you're Shushan, so how love is some effort. Something strange comes to my mind while reading about those episodes and meditating about the mysterious bond between Mordecai and the people. I'm afraid to say, Mordecai is not just an individual, or no? Not just a single person, or no? He's more than that. So what was he? What is he? He was not individual, he was a people, a nation. Isn't it almost crazy? Isn't it pure nonsense? Absurd? Can an individual turn into a people? A single person into a nation? One man into a community, a weak woman into a great kingdom of priests, and a holy nation? Is it possible? Or this thought is crazy? I don't know. All I know is that Judaism held the view that it is not absurd. It is possible. Not only possible, it happens many times. So let us take a look. God reached a covenant with Abraham. It is self-evident that God was not concerned with an individual, no matter how great. No matter how holy. God was concerned with a people, with a community, which he willed to enter into a covenantal relationship with him. So if this be the case, why was God satisfied with Abraham? Now let us take a look at Moses. God sent Moses to take the Jews out of Egypt. He stated distinctly, the Almighty stated distinctly, that he was concerned with a people as Ami Bnei Israel, with my people, the children of Israel. And yet, after the episode of the eagle, he told Moses, Psalacho, Psalacho, Shnei Luches Avonim. He addressed himself only to Moses. And the second revelation, in contrast with the first revelation, was a strictly private affair, or a private rendezvous between the God and Moses. The Ishal Yalimo, we'll read it tomorrow. The Gam Ishal Yiro, the Cholor Ahu. And no man shall come up with thee, neither let any man be seen throughout all the mount. In short, the second tablet, or the Torah, who was given to Moses exclusively, not to the people. How did the people receive the Torah? So the Gemara gives the answer. Moses was generous and passed it to the people. What the Talmud meant to say by that is that Moshe personified 600,000 Jews. The individual turned into a people, into a nation. Of course, it is, as I said before, it's a strange metamorphosis. Of course, it is a frightening equation. An individual equals a people. But it is a Talmudic equation. Shaku Kenegat. It is a mysterious identity. And yet, Yahadis believed in such a possibility. In the merger of the I with the multitude, the individual becomes the abode of the millions. And if the individual can prepare within himself an abode for God, the infinite and eternal, we also need us with your hand to be taken. If the individual can accommodate God within the depth and recesses of his personality, he certainly can invite millions, the same individual, millions of people, but there are finest people to abide in him. That's exactly what Moses, Abraham, and other Shluchei HaKeil did. Judaism thought very highly of the individual in history, no doubt about it. Judaism is opposed to the Marxist view of the Jewish Spengler. Though the philosophers of history, the individual plays no role in history, only the crowd, the masses, the collective. Judaism thought that the individual is a history major. But in contradistinction to Thomas Carlyle, Judaism did not glorify the individual as such. Never made a hero and a semi-god of him, of the individual. Instead, Judaism brought forth a new identity, individual hyphen people. The individual is hyphenated with the people. Single person, hyphen many. Lonely man, hyphen community. And God addresses himself to such awesome and strange personalities. He deals with them. He reaches covenant with them. And he establishes relationships with them. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Aaron, David. They were not just individuals. They were individuals in whom millions were abiding. Interesting is that our sages said, Moshe lemet, Moses did not die. David melech Yisrael chai v'kayam. We all say it, repeat it, every month. Yaakov lemet. All those individuals, peoples, an individual is a people, individuals are people. All those individuals in whom a multitude abides, all those individuals who merge with the community, in whom millions reside, do not die. Those individuals, they live forever. I wish to introduce just a saying by Rabbi Udali, which will cast the light upon what I just said. The Chover, you know, the Kuzari, is supposedly a record, a story of a debate, of a great debate, which took place many hundreds of years ago in the palace of the Melech HaKuzarim, of the King of the Khazar, between the Chover, it means the Jewish rabbi, as they translate it into English, because rabbi is most probably Chover, most probably scholar, and representative of Christianity, and also a representative of Islam. It was a long debate. But there the Chover, the Jew, somehow said something which is perhaps the most important statement in the whole book. He said, Yisroel shebeumot, kelev shebeivorim, rav koli v'rav bri. Israel, I don't mean it, I mean the Jewish people. Among the nations is like the heart amid the organs. It is the most sick and the most healthy of them all. Then he goes on to describe the function of the heart. Of course, it describes in terms of medieval medicine. The heart is visited without interruption by all sorts of diseases, as sadness, anxiety, envy, wrath, enmity, love, hate and fear. It means there's no need to say that the heart is the seat of the human personality, or the center of the human emotional life. There's no need to say so. Or we know that the heart reacts quickly to any emotional change in the human personality. Its constitution changes continually according to the vigor and weakness of respiration, movement, exertion, sleep, and wakefulness. These all affect the heart. What did Rabbi Yehuda Halevi once express by the beautiful aphorism? The Jewish heart was commissioned by God to feel the pain of the millions, to share the travail of the world, to be involved in the suffering of humanity. As a matter of fact, the Jew is involved in all crises and in all perplexing situations. The Jewish heartbeat, according to Rav Yehuda Halevi, belongs not to one person, but to the multitude. The Jewish heartbeat is not the heartbeat of the I, but of the Tao, of the He, of the They, of people one knows, and of people one has never met. In other words, the Jewish historical experience, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is a universal experience. Shall I say, with your permission, a cosmic experience? And I have good grounds for that, to me, which will support my statement. The Jew prays not only for himself, and not only for humanity, but even for the moon. Once a month, the Jew prays for the moon. The Jewish experience is all inclusive, all embracing, sympathetic to all. We have asked before, who are those individuals with whom the Almighty negotiates and signs treaties, as if they were not individuals but people? And indeed they are not people but people. Who are they? What is their role? I'll tell you what their role is. What the role of Israel, of the Jewish people, is vis-à-vis the world, those individuals. The role of those individuals is vis-à-vis the Jewish people. And if you want, I can write an equation. Shnuchei okei leYisrael, ke Yisrael umeis, shu keleiv shebeiloi. These individuals, prophets, messengers of God, are to the Jewish people what the latter is supposed to be to the world at large, namely its heart. The Shluchei Kehil belongs to the people, and the people belong to them. Their love is boundless, and their thoughts encompass all dimensions of time. Mordecai cried with a bitter and loud voice. That's what the Megillah told us. I would like to understand. Is a loud prayer more acceptable to God than a silent prayer? Does God measure the sound waves? The answer is, the cry He was loud and bitter because Mordecai was not a single person. But the people, his cry was the sum total of many individual prayers. The speech of the nation is always a loud one of all. The same is true of Esther. When she fasted, the whole community fasted with her. When she was clothed in malchus, in royal garments, the whole community felt that salvation is just a few steps away. Mordecai was the nation. Esther was the nation. Mordecai was the people. Esther was the people. You know who understood that? That's right. Who felt it? Who intuited it? Jews, I hope they did. But who intuited it? Who intuited the significance and importance of certain Jewish institutions? You know who? Our enemies. That Mordecai is not just an individual. That Mordecai is an individual nation. Person, people. Was discovered by Haman. By even the Enoch, the Shliach, Yod, the Mordechai Lefadei, Ki Gidulei, Es Am Mordechai. Haman's blind hatred intuited it. The Mordecai who defied him was not just an individual. Today is here, tomorrow is in the grave. Haman wouldn't have cared so much about an individual. It was not just a lonely, single, elderly Jew. Not just a lonely, single, elderly Jew has defied Haman. But Mordecai the people, Mordecai the nation, Mordecai the multitude. And if not Mordecai, someone else would defy it. Kayidus Bein of Mishleach Yod de Mordechai Levadei. Ki Gidulei Es Am Haifen Mordechai. That's why Vayivaki Shomon Lehashmi Es Kol HaYudim Asher Mechir. Kol HaYudim just comprise one great Mordechai. Now, let me analyze the nature of the assignment which we were entrusted to Esther and Mordecai. They were both charismatic personalities, both individuals, nations. Each one was an individual nation, an individual hyphen people. But Mordecai was a man. Esther was a woman. Man is a teacher. The woman is a disciple. Man initiates action. She finishes what man started, what he started. He is the theoretician. She is the implementer. He thinks in abstract. She in technological terms. He is at times naive, very. She is practical, and she knows particularly, and that's the most important matter now, the art of cunning. But please, cunning, I mean cunning in the positive sense. cunning, cunning is completely different from slyness. She knows the secret of a crafty and dexterous action. She knows how to engage in such action. Men quite often in this relation. The woman very seldom. Mordecai, the teacher, the educator, sees the initiative. Moreover, his clairvoyant gaze foretold him what was in store for his people. He foresaw the great tragedy. It was not his sudden, he was not struck suddenly by the disaster. Mordecai, it's very strange when you read in the Gilead, Mordecai refused to leave the palace. He sat steadily at the king's gate. We call it Tzureishenet. The Mordecai still, Yeshe Bishar Hanala. Why? Why was he sitting at the gate? What was he waiting for? Why couldn't he, leave the gate and go to this Medrash and join his colleagues? They say, Yeshiva, please. You know why he was afraid to leave the gate? I understood it when I had, unfortunately, this similar tragic experience. He was afraid, he refused to leave the gate for fear that something horrible, something monstrous may occur during his absence. It is a strange feeling, Rachmanov is one. As if, and it's an absurd feeling, as if one's presence may prevent the disaster from striking. You know it's wrong. I experienced a similar kind of foreboding during the illness of Mrs. Foresti. I never left her sick bed. Why? Not that she needed me, she didn't need me. Because I knew intuitively that once, that if I will be there, death will snatch her from me before I'll have a chance to return. Rachmanov is one. It happened like that on his Thursday, Tiny Sester, 6 years ago. His foreboding, Mordechai's foreboding, came true. His prescience was correct. Of course, he knew. He knew about it before it happened. Then we read in Gilo Mordechai Yoda, does not mean, Chazal said the Ruach HaKedesh, does not mean that he knew after the decree was signed. And the couriers who were sent out. It was simple to know. Mordechai Yoda is for Hashanah, he foresaw it before it happened. When disaster struck, he did not panic. Teacher does not panic. Clearly and objectively, he arrived at the conclusion, the strange conclusion. There was something which he couldn't understand. And finally, when the decree was signed and sent out to all the peoples, all the nations, he understood. What he couldn't grasp before, he suddenly arrived at the conclusion that Esther was summoned by the Ashkoche to play her part in the great drama of Israel running, the Jewish people and the nation. Suddenly, a great light went on, an illuminated event in which he could not connect before. He couldn't understand Ahasuerus' madness to invite Vashti to appear before his guests. He couldn't understand the ruthlessness with which he punished Vashti later. He couldn't understand, and this was the most puzzling fact. Esther's ascent to the throne, the ascent of a young, true girl, an exile, an immigrant, to the coveted throne, a queen of the Persian Empire, a queen of the South Long Persian Empire. Suddenly, events which were unexplained before, or rather unexplainable before, began suddenly to fit into a historical frame of reference, into a historical pattern. And it began to make sense. He immediately realized that it is Esther's turn now, historical turn. She and no one else has been selected, or as I may say, elected by the Ashtoreth as the redeemer of the Jewish people. He was, and he knew, that the Herculean task is her, not his. He may be initiator, but he will never implement it. He was not chosen. If he was not chosen, so what was the assignment which was entrusted to him at this hour of crisis, of distress? What assignment? The assignment consisted just of two simple performances. Two simple aspects. First, a very, what shall I say, classic and pedestrian flat task, to apprise Esther of the events that transpired just a few hours ago. Secondly, this was a more significant task, to make her realize that she, no one else, is charged by the Almighty. What I say is a mission of impossible. I leave out the word impossible. Everything is possible. This mission, which is the raison d'etre for her paradoxical rise to kingship. And the mission actually justifies her sitting on a throne, on a strange and alien throne. He starts as educator. And he was her educator, he raised her. As teacher, was to watch over Esther and to inspire and influence her. And as I said, Mordecai was Esther's teacher for many, many years. He brought her up, he raised her. Now, because he became once again a teacher, a prophet, even the small thin voice, which comes from within, exhorting, preaching, instructing, and inspiring. At this initial stage of the game, before Esther accepted the assignment, Mordechai was the leader. The man is the leader, the woman the power. Man was teacher, the woman the disciple. The voice of God addressed itself to Esther through Mordechai. Mordechai was bold, aggressive, initiated action. He knew first, he conveyed the news to Esther. And that is the reason why Mordechai came into the inner city, and only there he cried bitterly and aloud. I ask again the question, why was this manifestation necessary? Must the prayer be exhibited? In order to be efficacious? The answer is plain. He tried to draw the attention of Esther. Had he tried at home, Esther would not have been informed about the development. In fact, his calculations were correct. The news reached Esther quickly. He achieved first objective, the line of communication. The line of communication was opened or was established between him and Esther. And suddenly the scene changes. Roles are shifted. The main actor is demoted to a less significant prominent position, and the central role is turned over today, until now, lesser figure. At this juncture, Esther took over. She became the master, Mordechai. However, when it came to implementation, the woman is the master. The implementation of any plan is a technological feat which consists in the selection and employment of the most effective means for the sake of achieving a desired end. This is what we call cunning, which is the forte of the woman. Our sages said, "Bino yesero nitno leisho." The woman was endowed with a more incisive intuition and better practical judgment than the man. Esther became the main actor. Mordecai had to listen to her. Vayavir Mordecai, Vayad Kechel Asher Kitzo, all of Esther. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther had commanded it. If we should glance through the Megillah once again, we'll notice that there was a basic controversy, a basic disagreement between Mordecai and Esther concerning the proper course of action. What do I mean by that? I mean, you all know the Megillah, no, don't you? Megillah is basically the best known book of the Bible, the best known book of the Bible. There was a basic disagreement, and Esther won. And she refused to listen to Mordecai, and she won. Mordecai held the view that immediate, spontaneous action on the part of Esther is inevitable. Esther, in his opinion, was supposed to appear before the king, of course taking the risk of being rejected and executed, and plead with him hysterically, immediately. He should spare the people. Mori ala melech, umi ischanen, ulubak ischufon avalame. Did Esther act like that? When Esther appeared in the inner court and the king accepted her and let her touch the scepter, did she right away prostrate herself, embrace his knees, hug his knees, and ask for mercy? No, she did. This was the way Mordecai understood, but this was not the way Esther understood. Esther did not concur with Mordecai. She went to the king. However, all she did when she was received by the king consisted to what? In extending an invitation to the king to attend the banquet, to attend the banquet which she was giving in his honor. Now that was a Persian custom too, not only an American custom. Not a single word, not a single tear about the decree. Not a single word about the tragic fate of the people was mentioned. Moreover, she ignored the whole issue even at the banquet. Even when the king had came to the banquet. Vayomer HaMelech l'Esther v'mishta ha'yayin. What did she say? She didn't mention a word. She was procrastinating. Apparently, she was not sure. She was waiting for something. She delayed. I mean, when the king asked her to tell him to tell him the nature of her petition, she delayed. She was waiting for something.
for something to happen. What was she waiting for? What was she waiting for?
In order to understand Esther's tactics and the reason for her disagreement with Mordecai, we must simply cast another glance at the events the way they are recorded in the Megillah. We may discover a new focus in the whole story. But I'm not going to write fiction or to write you a novel. I'm not a writer, I'm too old for it.
What happened actually, sister? What happened, sister? What was the background of those bizarre events? What is the story we find in small print between the lines?
I believe that the Talmudic interpretation would eliminate many dark spots and fill in many gaps in this story. Ahasuerus, according to the Talmud, was not a legitimate heir to the throne. He was a plebeian. According to the Talmud, his father was a steward in the charge of horses for Belshazzar, the king of Babylon. Belshazzar was the father of Vashti. She was a princess. Apparently, he became king, like Napoleon thousands of years later, by the virtue of his mighty sword. Like Napoleon, Ahasuerus was most probably a brilliant strategist, an excellent warrior. He destroyed ruthlessly his opponent and ascended to the throne. That's how the Talmud describes Ahasuerus. However, I'm not going to write a detective story here. There was apparently an underground movement, a resistance. How do I know, you'll ask me? How do I know? I'll tell you how I know that. First of all, there was no reason why people should not hate the Ahasuerus. A very coarse, a very brutal time. What, I mean, the case of Dixon the Seventh, the two eunuchs, the bodyguard of the king, who conspired to assassinate him, is quite revealing. There were people in the royal palace who wanted to remove Ahasuerus from the throne. In fact, what I'm going to say here is already mentioned by the Malbim. In fact, the whole feast is the crazy feast of the 180 days, 7 days, a year of feasting and celebrating the whole feast was due to Ahasuerus' sense of inferiority and insecurity. In a primitive way, he wanted to buttress his rule and to assert himself and to strengthen his kingdom by exhibiting his method. He displayed his wealth and tried unsuccessfully to show off his beautiful queen in order to impress his vassals, friends and enemies alike. When we read the story, not the story, about the speech delivered by Memuchan, according to the sages, Memuchan was Haman, just a pseudonym of Haman. We don't understand, actually, Memuchan's speech. And the fascinating about the probability of women's insurrection and revolution.
I'm not afraid. What kind of a rebellion did Memuchan anticipate? What was he afraid of? Of a kitchen debate.
The husband will have, will be forced to do the cooking and baking, and the wife will go off to business.
What was he talking about? ויהיים הזה כמענו אסתור אסתור מודאי וכן שר המלך וכדאי בזוי וכן כזאת מה זה הספיק? מה זה נוסף נראה?
And then why was it included in the Jewish? That's all the Jewish is a part of the scripture. So apparently it's very important. However, let us not forget that in antiquity the victor often married the widow or the daughter of the enemy or the enemy king whom he defeated in battle. It was a common practice. Such a marriage most probably was supposed to symbolize or to sanction the victory and sanction the right of the winner to the throne and everything else which goes with the throne. Everything was taken away, including the queen or the princess. Our sages tell us that Vashti was the daughter of Balthasar, and the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Yes. An aristocrat, a blue blood, who looked, of course, upon her parveni husband, or parveni nouveau-riche husband, with contempt and hate. The Gemara tells us that when she refused to appear before the guests, at the request of Ahasuerus, she sent to him the following answer. Bara Uraichi, I'll read it in Aramaic. Bara Uraichi de Abo. Abo mekabel alte chamre sosev lerove. Vahai gavri ishtate de chamre. Thou, she addressed Ahasuerus, son of my father Stuart, in charge of the whole. My father drank wine in the presence of the thousand and never got drunk. And that man has become selfless with a little bit of wine. This remark is characteristic of the patrician's disgust with the self-proclaimer who cannot hold his liquor. His liquor. Exactly. Ahasuerus couldn't hold his liquor. The hate was mutual. Ahasuerus reciprocated. However, he was afraid to kill her because he thought that her presence at his side, the presence of the aristocratic princess, the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, the daughter of Belshazzar, enhances his prestige and glory. That's why Ahasuerus was afraid and did not know what to do after he was publicly abused and insulted by her. In spite of the fact that he was raging, he was not ready to execute her. When you read in the Bible, you see that Ahasuerus was afraid. If Ahasuerus knew what he has to do, he wouldn't have consulted the royal council. Somehow, in spite of the fact that he was raging, he was not ready to execute her out of fear that the execution of the aristocratic queen might precipitate a revolution. In his confusion, he consulted with the royal council. Otherwise, he would have issued orders all by himself, and he would not have, I mean, consulted the council. Ahasuerus was never reluctant to destroy a person who stood in his way. There was no need for Memuchan's speech and advice. Ahasuerus apparently was perplexed. He didn't know what to do. Memuchan warned and Ahasuerus was ready to be lenient and forgive him. Memuchan apparently warned Ahasuerus that leniency vis-à-vis a queen who mocked the king publicly is a greater risk than swift punishment. Her refusal to appear and the insulting words she uttered might serve as the signal to all captive women who will be joined by the underground to rise against the king. Memuchan was not concerned because every official in Ahasuerus' empire married a daughter of the enemy official, of equal rank. So the women were not just wives, they were captives. Memuchan was not concerned over a kitchen revolution or a debate, but over a real revolution in the Persian Empire. I am certain, cannot take an oath, but I am pretty certain, that Haman's promotion to the office of Prime Minister was due to Ahasuerus' paranoid fears. Haman was to Ahasuerus what Daniel was thousands of years later to study. I am certain about it. Our Savior said, Memuchan zeu Haman. Memuchan is the pseudonym of Haman. And it was in the interest of Haman to keep the king in a state of nervous tension and restlessness. It was in the interest of Haman to magnify the danger and drive the king to insanity. Daria, as Husserl tells in his memoirs, or memoirs are authentic or not, I don't know. But anyway, it's a good book. As Beria tells in his memoirs, I mean not Beria, Husserl, Beria used to do the same to Stalin. For why did Haman do it to Ahasuerus and Beria to Stalin? Because a secure and sane king could not have tolerated a brute like Haman. A sick, frightened king relied on Haman. As a matter of fact, the appointment of Haman followed the big son of Sarah's episode. ביום המוערה ומאוד חייסי בשער המלך בקצון המסרש לפני שריסי עשה ואירח מוסכי למלך החסרש היובל הדבר למוד חי ואתה גנס על המלך בשם מוד חוי והזוק של הדבר ימוצי והיתור שני המלאית והיקוס בשם בדבר יש היומים לפני המלך הורה דבר קריא קשת הסברך ואת יוקן ריאה זה לא נהיה פה והיא אחר הדבר המלך גידה למלך החסרש ושומע והיה עוד הפוינטת after I forgot the name now, he was the governor of Petersburg, was killed by the Sassanid. Even this absurd law, which Esther mentioned, begins to make sense. If we see it against that background of a paranoid king, as a commissary Miso, as a Yove, a Lachotzer Apnimis, as a Lei Yikore, Achaz Dosri Lohomi, makes no sense. It was a security and safety measure. The palace, certainly, the palace ground, were closely guarded. Whoever clandestinely, surreptitiously, penetrated the inner core was taken for a conspirator and executed. That was it. There is no doubt that Haman's indictment of the Jewish people before Ahasuerus aimed at arousing suspicions, at arousing in Ahasuerus suspicions concerning their loyalty to the throne. The so-called bill of particulars, which Haman presented to the king, contains either two or three charges. First charge, yesh me'am echot. It depends how you translate the word echot. You may translate the word echot, there is a certain people. But you may also translate the word echot, there is a unique people or a united people. It means the Jews are united. It's an old complaint against the Jews. Number one. Number two, Mephuzor and Pharaoh Beno Ami scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom. Second charge. Third charge. The Dosayim Shenish Mikolom and their laws are different from those of every people. Two questions rise. Why should the king be concerned with the dispersion of the Jews throughout his empire? What kind of a complaint is that? The Jews were indicted because they were dispersed and scattered all over the far-flung empire. So what's wrong with it? Second, why should the king mind the unique Jewish law? The Megillah has emphasized many times the polyglottic and multinational character of the empire. Was polyglottic? When they used to send out mail, the Bible was not written in Persian. In Persian for the Persians. But for all other people, I mean, the mail was written in the vernacular. The latter, I mean the Persian Empire, who was not a homogeneous, but a diverse community. So what's wrong with a people who professes a singular faith? There was no religious persecution in Persia. Persia resented that regard to Rome. Rome didn't care about it. The cultural diversity of that empire. All Rome demanded its political allegiance. The answer, I believe, is simple. The Jews, since they have outlandish mores and strange customs, a unique mentality, and an incomprehensible outlook on the world, you can never guess what their attitude toward our institutions is or will be the next step. They are simply unpredictable. If you see a freakish type, unique, singular, you will say he's unpredictable. You don't know his reactions and his motivations. One cannot gauge, Haman said, the psychological reactions and motivations of the Jew. Now he is loyal, tomorrow he might plot or conspire against the king. So they are not reliable, they are not trustworthy. I mean, usually when you suspect a stranger, why do you suspect the stranger? Because you don't know him. And if you don't know him, you don't know his reactions and motivations, his manner of responding to stimuli, to phenomena. That's what Haman said to the king.
You don't know, you can never be sure about the Jews. Today, perhaps that doesn't. But what will happen overnight, no one can predict.
Secondly, Rahimel says, very cleverly, if the Jews should decide to plot and to join the underground, then I'm afraid the king will be confronted with a menace of gigantic proportions. The danger will be great because of two reasons. First, they are a united, well-organized, and disciplined people. We still hear this kind of complaining. They are clannish, extremely obstinate, yeshnei amechos, unique people. Second, due to their dispersion and ubiquity, wherever you cast the stone, find the Jew. The Jew will carry the message of rebellion throughout your entire empire. There are Jews in every town, village, hamlet, and city. It would be humanly impossible to control and watch them. They are in contact with all races and peoples, populating the far-flung land of your majesty. An insurrection by the Jews will spread quickly like wildfire. We all be helpless. Suppression of such a revolution, rebellion, borders on the absurdity. Under such circumstances, I recommend your majesty that the Jews be exterminated. Very logical. V'lamelech en sheva la'anichem. It is against the best interest of the king to permit such a status quo to continue. Very logical. V'lamelech en sheva la'anichem. It is against the best interest of the king to permit such a status quo to continue. Okay. Now we understand why Ahasuerus consented at once to let Haman execute his satanic plan. It is right. He didn't ask even who they are. He has no knowledge who the people is. He has no knowledge. Because when Esther told him, it's a muse of Israel. When a paranoid who lives in fear at some imaginary monster fiend is given an opportunity to fix the blame upon a certain person or group, then all human inhibitions and moral controls are abandoned. The paranoid person has in such a situation one dominant, irresistible urge to destroy, because he thinks that his safety can only be attained through destruction. It's exactly, this describes exactly the mentality of God. It is the same mentality Ahasuerus shared. Esther, that's what Mordechai didn't know. Esther, with her incisive intelligence, understood that no plea addressed to the king would produce any results. Hysterical crying, supplications, begging, will at best remain ineffectual. At worst, they may inflict more harm. Since Haman succeeded, and Esther knew that, simply to brainwash Ahasuerus, and to arouse in him a paranoid, mortal fear of assassins and rebels, there is no human power in the world which will be capable to dissuade Ahasuerus from destroying his imaginary enemies. Could anyone sway Stalin from implementing his mad designs? I mean, Khrushchev writes that many times, I mean, of course, all his cohorts were cowards, they never dared. But once a day, very close friends, who was a devoted communist, a pioneer, who spent years in the Tsarist jails and prisons, who was suddenly accused of high treason, of conspiring with the United States and England and France, and was sentenced to death. And the simple dead Stalin did not respond. Begging is useless when a paranoid mind is convinced that someone or that this individual is ready to conspire and plot against him. Could anyone free Stalin from his meditations? He had to exterminate hundreds of thousands who were involved in the imaginary plot. The same was true of Ivan the Terrible, of Peter the Great, and Philip II of Spain. The two, Philip of Spain and Ivan the Terrible, executed their own sons. There's no logical argument which can persuade a paranoid mind that he's wrong in his calculations and thinking. Teaching a paranoid mind, or convincing a paranoid mind, is an absurdity. Esther knew that very well. And that's why she disregarded Mordecai's advice to come into the king and to prostrate herself before him, to cry and to hug his knees and plead for her people. It would have been useless at best. Esther knew that she could avail herself of one method only. One method only. What do you say, what method? Namely, to turn the tables on Haman. Not to ask for his marriage, not to plead with him, not to petition him. All that will be a futile attempt, but to turn the tables on Haman.
Tell me which one, what do you have to
put up? This is Yeshiva, this is your Yeshiva, this is the television, and these are here.
The mics?
Yeah, these are your mics.
So the question is, the cover?
No, this one is basically the PA system, one around those there.
All right.
I'll try and see if it's good.
All right, is it audible? No, it's there. No one here. So what?
See if it's good.
All right. No, no. It's a perennial problem here. All right. This is better now. Do you hear me?
No.
No? Do you hear me? You have another mic? Where is it? Table? Perhaps you love the mic, I mean. What did you say?
This is a microphone.
This is a microphone for the, yes. For the,
all right, this and this. All microphones.
All right. There is a lot.
Make it move higher.
Yeah, I don't believe it. All right, let me start, all right? I mean, you all know the saying in Pirkei Avos. Ayin kotzer, amrocha merubo. Is it audible? It's late. It's 8 o'clock. The Afilim Afilim and the lecturer is lazy and tired and exhausted. The Balabai is dichit and the crowd is big. However, the reward is enormous. I mean, in spiritual times. What I'm going to do today, I'm trying to develop kind of a metaphysique of poem. It sounds like contradictio in adjecto. Purim is a day of gaiety. Metaphysique, the word metaphysique, whatever the meaning is, reflects a serious mood. And Purim and a serious mood are mutually exclusive. But let us investigate, and I want to tell you, I'm investigating on not only on homiletical grounds or philosophical grounds, but on halachical grounds, an halachic viewpoint. The Gemara Megillah, Tractate Megillah, says, Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Chai Rodom Litris es HaMegillah Balayla, ולשני סבייה, שנאמר, מלכי, אקרו לחוימום ולסענה, לילה ולאיתו מיולי. I'm just quoting now, I'll translate it. איתנו נאמר, אמר אף חלבו, אמר אבולה, אמר אולה, בירוי, חי ודום ליקרס סמגילה בלילה, ולשני סבייה, שנאמר למען זמך חובד ולידי מדשב ולקאי לילה מדרך. Now let me translate it. Rabbi Shua ben Levi said, one is duty bound to read the Megillah in the evening and to reread it, to repeat it a second time in the morning. As it is written, proof that the Megillah should be read twice, O my God, I call by day, but thou answerest not. And at night, and there is no surcease for me. Then the Gemara continues, Itmaname, we have also learned, the Gemara continues, Rabbi Chelbo, in the name of Ula, of Biroi, of place, which was called Biroi, stated, again, one is commanded to read the Megillah in the evening as well as in the morning, as it is written, so that my glory may sing praise to thee and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I will give thanks unto thee forever. Two identical statements, correct? However, two contradictory reasons. Two prima facie and mutually exclusive verses were quoted by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi and Ula, who formulated the same halacha. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi quoted the verse from the Psalm 22, the famous Tehillim Kedar Lomar Zaftoni Psalm, prayer, most probably of an individual in distress, who was forsaken and abandoned by everybody. This psalm reflects the cry of total despair, the shriek of a frightened, lonely child who has suddenly discovered that his mother is gone, that she had left him. Kele kele lama zaftoni. And according to our tradition, this psalm was recited by Esther on her way to the inner court of Ahasuerus, by Yom HaShlishi, on the third day. In a word, it's a psalm of a person who lost almost hope and out of the depth, the profundity of despair and misery and agony, he petitions the Almighty. From that, some Rabbi Shira Levi inferred that one must read the Megillah at night as well in the daytime. In other words, the reading of the Megillah was by Rabbi Shira Levi identified or equated with the offering of a prayer to the Almighty from the straits of distress. It was reading of the Megillah was identified by Rabbi Shira Levi with addressing a petition to the Almighty from the depths of agony and misery. Rabbi Chelvo, in the name of Ullah, introduced another verse. His verse is from Psalm 30. Mizmor Shir Chanukah Shabbos Leilovich. This is the jubilant psalm of dedication. Of thanksgiving by an individual who was miraculously cured. Be'erev yomim bechi v'labek yarino. Weeping might have tarried for the night, but joy came in the morning. The sick person who miraculously was saved from death, he overflows with gratitude. He does not just say thank you to the Almighty. He sings an incessant hymn of praise and hallow, a day as well as at night. Therefore, Ullah concluded, one must recite the Megillah in the evening and also in the morning. In other words, Ullah identifies and equates the reading of the Megillah with offering of praise and thanks to the Almighty. The Megillah, according to Ullah, is a great song of gratitude, for it is good from to sing praise to the Lord. And in fact, the famous statement by Rabbi Chiyosu Zuyimula, the reading of the Megillah is to be equated with the recital of Hallel, confirms Ullah's opinion. Of course, the question arises, what actually is the Megillah? A book of human sorrow and misery, warranting ceaseless supplication and crying, or it is a book of glory and gladness, precipitating the singing of Hallel about God's glory and His majesty. Because according to Rabbi Shira Levi, the book of the Megillah is a book of human sorrow, of human distress. It is the cry of the lonely person to the Almighty. According to Chelvo and Ullah, the reading of the Megillah is a jubilant song of thanksgiving and praise for a person who was cured and redeemed by the Almighty. What kind of a book is the Megillah? The answer is simple. Both characterizations are correct. The Megillah contains two stories, not one story. The story of human happiness and fulfillment, as well as the story of human misery and distress, and human loneliness and hopelessness. The reading of the Megillah is a dialectical performance. We do pray while we read the Megillah, because we are in distress. We do thank God while we read the Megillah and relate His wonders, for we have found refuge in Him. He just saved us. Consequently, the whole character of Purim changes. It is not just, as people assume, a day of hilarious feasting, drinking, merrymaking, and gaiety, to the extent of self-forgetfulness. I mean, when we speak of Purim, by mere association, we remind ourselves of the famous Maimar and Gemara. Chai vodu yisur bepur yad yad ben boruch, Mordechai l'orah Haman. His Purim is not just a day of hilarious feasting, drinking, and gaiety, but is also a day of introspection and serious self-examination. Purim is a day of meditation. I'm not, it's contrary to the popular interpretation of Purim. Since mysticism is very popular nowadays in the United States, particularly among the young, any freakish behavior is classified under mysticism. So let me tell you what the mystics say about Purim. The mystics speak of five letters of Purim, which occur also in Yom Kippur. Apparently, they say, there is a common denominator in both festivals. One is the most hilarious and noisy, and the other one is the most solemn, awesome, and fear-inspiring. But there is a common denominator in both of them, in Yom Kippurim and in Purim. A strange equation has been formulated by the mystics. All right? Could somebody formulate the equation? Right. In mathematical categories, Yom Kippurim equals Purim plus Chof Yud. Correct? Kippurim. No wonder that many gaining, among them I believe Rav Nathan Goyen, advised us the Tachanun Dinatomiket Antoim. Since Purim is a day of supplication and petition. It comes as a surprise, but when you begin to investigate Aloha, you see that this is a basic definition of, a basic interpretation, I mean, of Purim. As a matter of fact, the whole institution of Tiny Sesta preceding Purim, we'll observe it on his next Thursday meal session. The whole institution rests upon this very dichotomy inherent in the festival of Purim and upon the paradoxical halachic requirement. It's a paradoxical requirement that Purim be observed both as a day of prayer and as a day of joyous celebration. Since it is impossible to comply with this paradoxical requirement, the rabbis advanced the observance of the prayer aspect of Purim, the prayer aspect of Purim, to the 13th of Adar. And the serious, prayerful mood, the frequent cry or shriek accompanying an itonis, in Tanis Esther is a regular itonis, the recital of Shliches, or the reading of Avinu Malkeinu, this serious mood belongs and is closely related to the very observance of Purim. Tainis Esther is not to be treated as an extraneous addendum to Purim, like Tainis Kerem is in relationship to Pesach. Tainis Kerem is an extraneous addendum to Pesach. It's not a part of the holiday of Pesach. Tainis Esther is not to be treated like that. It is a genuine Purim day on which the words of the psalmist, Eretai Ekra Lachoyim Amalesane, Laila Veleit Mirli, are translated literally into a liturgical reality. As a matter of fact, if you look up in Rambam, it is apparently that the Rambam is of the same opinion. There is an element, an aspect of prayer and supplication. There is a passional experience involved in the whole drama of Purim. But I cannot spend too much time on it. Of course, a question rises. How can Purim encompass two contradictory aspects? I would reformulate the question. On what metaphysical fact is this dialectic of Purim based? I believe that the answer is to be found in a human situation, if I may use the jargon of the existentialist. Man is a frightened being. When I say frightened being, I don't mean psychologically. I mean ontologically, existentially. He is full of anxiety. Everybody knows about it. Which is a result of his greatness. This anxiety is not a result of human smallness, but of human greatness. He is frightened because he is great. He possesses faculties which have been denied to other creatures. Those unique faculties are the source of his fears and his troubles. Man basically is great and singular because he is capable of living in three realities at the same time. He can live in the reality of memory, accompanied by the melancholy awareness of things and people long gone. He can also live, and he does live, of course, in the reality which he can apprehend with his five senses, in the perceptual reality, what do you call it, present. However, men can also live in a third reality, in that of anticipation, where existence is equated with expectancy or tension, and where man is confronted by the unknown, and since it's unknown, it is frightening. What does the future hold in store for me? Man keeps asking himself without being able to answer this persistent question. The beast, for instance, is mortal, just as man is. In fact, the lifespan of the animal is much shorter, usually, there are exceptions, much shorter than that of man. However, the latter does not know of death It possesses neither memory nor the capability of anticipating events. So death is no problem to him, to the animal. Man has this capacity, the capability. Man is an anticipatory being, and therefore a frightened being and an unhappy being. In a word, man is an insecure, frightened being. Or in other words, man, and I believe that this should be introduced as a new category in the religious thinking, man is a vulnerable being, vulnerability. He is exposed to the absurd what Aristotle calls, and Maimonides in some places just uses the expression, to the absurd accident. Maimonides calls it carry. To at best, is exposed to at best an indifferent destiny. And man knows all that, and he is aware of his vulnerability and steady exposure. Which book Dietrich did speak of human vulnerability? Which book? Yeah? Which book? Ah? Here. Simple. Yeah. Basically, here does not speak of the vulnerability of man. Of course, the first chapter, the story of here is, of course, tells us about vulnerability and exposure of man, yes. But the problem is not in the discussion, in dialogue between Job and his friends, Eliphaz, Sofar, and Bildad, and Shuchi. Vulnerability was not discussed, not at all. Justice was discussed, yes. Job had many problems, yeah, but not vulnerability. Vulnerability is mentioned in two stories, in two books. You know where? Huh? Kehelet, of course, and also a number of times in Kehelet. But the one who simply defined human vulnerability, it was Kehelet. What verse in Kehelet? What verse in Kehelet? Kiryeda odo misitei kadogim shenechozim bamtsudo vechatziporim rachuzis bepach vohem yekshim bnei odom leisro kishetipel aleyem kisein. For man knows not his time as the fishes that are taken in an evil net. Even so are the sons of men, snared in an evil time, when it falls suddenly upon them. Now I'll ask you a question. On what word should emphasis be placed? What should be underlined here in the whole passage? In the whole verse? What word should be underlined? What? I don't even know fish, I like fish. But... Kiryeda, yes, No, I don't know, perhaps you are right, I'm wrong, but I believe that Dorish Hozog, the emphasis, the accent should be placed upon what word? Titan, correct. Pitam. The emphasis should be placed upon the word Pitam. Suddenness. When fate strikes, it strikes suddenly, unexpectedly. Not always does sickness announce its coming, God forbid, through pain. Or sometimes sickness is not preceded by a signal. Nor does a violent economic or political change warn people in advance. Therefore, now there is an halachic conclusion from that. What is the halachic conclusion to be to be drawn from vulnerability of man, particularly the sudden change in each affairs in his life, the sudden blow, the unexpected surprise attack. There's a very important, halakhic conclusion. Without that, tefillah would be an impossibility. Because, let me use here just a term from our halakhic lingo, tamechayev amin, the factor which precipitates prayer, or the source of prayer. Halakhically, I'm not speaking here philosophically or theologically, what is the halakhic factor which engenders the obligation to pray, the duty to petition the Almighty? Sorrow or tzeirach? Sorrow, correct, or I would, usually we interpret sorrow in terms of catastrophe, disaster. But tzeirach, need, human need, tzorche yodam, human need. While mystical prayer, for instance, placed the emphasis upon praise and thanksgiving and hymnal singing, Yahadus placed the accent upon petitional prayer, the sort of selfish, egotistic or egoistic prayer. But that prayer is the result of need. If there is no need, if a man feels that he's happy, feels happy and satisfied, all his needs are being gratified, not only there is no need for prayer, he shouldn't pray. Then every bracha would be a bracha lebatela. He shouldn't pray. If man prays, it is because he is in need, in constant need. Why is man in constant need? Because man is vulnerable. Therefore, man is always in need. Therefore, we recite our prayers 3 times a day. One is, for instance, one is healthy. I just was discharged by the hospital. And they gave me a clean bill of health. But still, the next prayer, I recite Refrainu Ad Hashem Ben Rofe. Why? Why should I petition God for healing and cure? I don't need any cure. I don't need any medical help. Yes, I don't need now, then you know what the answer is. I don't need help now, medical help. But I know not how I feel 5 minutes hence, or 5 seconds. For instance, a very rich man, a millionaire, asks God for panos, for a livelihood, that he provided him with a livelihood. Isn't it funny? Not at all. Why? He knows nothing about the following day, or about the morrow. In other words, if we take into consideration human vulnerability, we must arrive at one conclusion. There is no complete redemption. Of course, the Erev Yalim Bechi, at night, man was in distress. Bameitzah. In the morning, he woke up and he found himself free, breathing the clear air of Merchavto, of God's boundless spaces. This happened, the miracle happened. Yet, what his fate will be the next morning, he does not know. Vulnerability of man is the great tragic experience of man, and therefore, there is no complete halal. Therefore, the halakhic division of tefillah into two parts, basically three parts, but let us eliminate one part, into Shevach Ve'edoeh, into praise and thanksgiving, and petitioner. And petition is a relative one. The division is not an absolute, strict division. There is no absolute Hallel service. Cannot be a service completely dedicated to Hallel. Nor is there pure petition. The Halacha speaks of Hallel, when the Halacha speaks of Hallel, he does so in a qualified manner. There is no thanksgiving which does not contain petition. Because no matter how great the miracle was, there is no promise. No promise is given. That the catastrophic events, disastrous events, will not repeat themselves, will not reoccur. Every song of glory must be in willingly and in supplication. The song of joy coming from a liberated, happy man is ipso facto a cry from a frightened man. In fact, Hallel HaMitzri, you say Hallel HaMitzri, the exalted song of joy, the Hallel par excellence, consists of two parts, praise and thanksgiving on the one hand. For instance, the Psalms, Hallel Korah, Luav, the Hashem, or Betzis Yisrael, Mitzvahim, belong to the category of praise and thanksgiving, but there is another part of prayer and petition, like Ravati, Leilonu, and the famous refrain, Ono Abishem Meshiro. Very strange. Just 5 minutes ago, I was singing a great triumphant song of victory. The face is from Israel in the Siakim Mamlez. It's really touching Israel Mamshweser. And now I see myself forsaken, forgotten. And I'm appealing for help from the Almighty. Ono Abishem Meshiyano. Help, because I'm lonely. I'm lost. To recite Hallel halachically means to sing and to cry at the same time. It is, of course, paradoxical, but the Jew is a paradoxical person in general, and we are a paradoxical people. But this paradoxality is a part of our liturgy. No wonder that Purim is both a day of joyous celebration and a day of prayer and meditation. No wonder that the Kriyas Amgile is equated with that of Hallel, with the recital of praise, as well with Tachanunim, with the offering of prayers. Of course, the miracle was great, staggering, defying human imagination. The person who was supposed to be executed on the gallows was suddenly promoted to the office of viceroy, a prime minister. And the people who were doomed to total annihilation suddenly emerged as victorious. True, it was a great miracle. No doubt that that event deserves to be recorded for posterity, be remembered and celebrated. No doubt about it. That's why the Kriyas Amgile was ordained and Purim declared as a day of joy and gladness. However, its circumstances and events can change so quickly literally, overnight, if a prime minister who just yesterday enjoyed the full confidence and trust of the king, who was suddenly convicted and executed, then I'm not sorry for it. Who is wise enough, wise and clairvoyant enough to assure us that the same unreasonable, absurd, neurotic change of mood and mind will not repeat itself? Where is the fortune teller who could assert or assure us that Ahasuerus will not replace Esther Amalke with another fair woman, and that he'll do to her exactly what he did to Vashti, his first dream? The Megillah in general is the book of the specific vulnerability of man, and specifically of the vulnerability of the Jew. The events recorded in the Megillah are nonsensical. A king signs away the lives of hundreds of thousands of people without even inquiring about their identity. He never asks Thomas who these people is or those people are. Three or four days later, he denies the whole story. He does not remember, he says, that such an edict was ever signed and sealed, and that Haman was responsible for it. Can such a king be relied upon? Less than on the administration of Washington. Purim could not have been introduced just as a festival, as a day of merrymaking. Purim had to be set up as a dual holiday, dual in character and dual in manner of observance. Where did the Jew experience the most absurd vulnerability, if not Yeshusha? Vulnerability of man is not only a tragic vulnerability of man is not only a tragic truth or effect, it is more than that. The vulnerability of man is an ethical, halachic postulate. This awareness, the awareness of vulnerability, of being exposed, and suddenly the awareness of the suddenness of the attack, engenders many ethical virtues, among which the most important one is humility. Without vulnerability, there is no humility. Without the awareness of vulnerability, there is no modesty. Of course, we all know that humility is perhaps the highest ethical virtue. Maimonides even suspended his golden rule, the rule of the golden mean, which applied to many emotions, to all emotions. He did suspend this rule vis-à-vis humility. One has got to be very humble. Evesh Faruach made, Evesh Faruach. Now is a question, all right, humility is very important. The opposite of humility is arrogance, pride, vanity. How can humility be achieved? And there's another question. Why should men be modest? Why should men be shy? Why should he be humble? Particularly, why should successful men be humble? He has the right, prima facie, to be proud of himself, to be arrogant toward those who did not succeed in life, toward those who failed in life. In fact, man is inclined to be arrogant, to be impudent, to be aggressive. Man is inclined to reach out for things which are above and beyond his legitimate reach. Arrogance of man is, of course, the consequence of victory. The feelings of self-assurance, self-righteousness, which accompany success, they result in pride and in arrogance. However, all those feelings, human pride and arrogance, disappear the very moment man becomes aware of his vulnerability and of the suddenness with which fortune changes. In other words, the awareness of vulnerability of man is a cathartic awareness, a cleansing awareness, awareness which purges man, which has a redemptive impact upon man. It is awareness which ennobles man, because the alternative is pride and vanity. Humility is the expression of that awareness. We will read in the Megillah, Mordechai Misalech Nechatsa Beis Anoshim Vodas Eshlom Esther Uma Yosebo. Had Mordechai abandoned caution and adopted the attitude of the arrogant fool, of the so-called Mubarish, had he let everybody know that he was the father or uncle, I don't know, I mean, what he could have said, of the queen. Of course, I mean, by telling the people, the courtiers and the servants of the royal palace, he would have told them that he is related to the queen, related, very close relation to the queen. He would have commanded their respect. But however, had he been proud and vain and boastful, had he bragged about the fact that he is a relation of the queen, the whole miracle would not have happened. The miracle was made possible by Mordecai's caution and humility. He was silent, humble,
He was waiting for something to happen. He knew that the more fantastic the success story is, the more vulnerable man is. The most vulnerable man in the United States is the president. Man is vulnerable, is the vulnerability of man is proportionate to his greatness. The greater the success, the more vulnerable he is, and the more intense is the need for prayer. Mordechai knew that Esther climbed up to the very heights of success. But the more cautious Mordechai was, and because of Mordechai's humility, and because of the awareness of vulnerability and caution, the great miracle happened, took place. Let me make here a parenthetical remark, and please, I don't want you to misinterpret me. We'll tell you what I have in mind. And don't try to distort what I said. Because lately people are distorting my statements. The vulnerability of the Jew is not limited to the Jew in the diaspora. Of course, the Megillah relates the story of a diaspora community. However, the destiny charged vulnerability awareness of the Jew is universal. It is an integral part of the universal Jewish, universal experience of man in general and the Jewish experience in particular. And as such, it is all inclusive, all encompassing. It applies to everybody, to individual and state, to private person and community. We are all vulnerable. The government in Israel, in general, and the top echelon of the military leadership lived during 7 years in a mood of arrogance and forgot the principle of vulnerability of man. No one is an exception to the rule. No one is excluded from that. That's why we find ourselves in a very unpleasant situation, to say the least. Vulnerability leads to humility, humility to caution, and caution leads to success. But if the awareness of vulnerability is lacking, then man becomes arrogant, and arrogance leads to errors and to mistakes. And mistakes are the cause of failure. It's good to remember now, because we are confronted by a horrible enemy. We will have to make very, very serious decisions. In the halacha, the principle of vulnerability makes cure possible. Man is always in it. But many halachas
are rooted in the fact of that man is a vulnerable being. For instance, we have many laws pertaining to safety, and our code is replete with them. In Sosin Domvi Secho, you build a marker around your house, your roof. All those laws are rooted in the notion of human exposure to this so-called accident. In my opinion, the whole concept of Vasus Yod Vatera build a fence around the law is rooted in the notion of vulnerability of not only physical but also spiritual man. Not only the body is vulnerable, but the human spirit is vulnerable, exposed. The human intellect, the human fantasy are exposed to all kinds of pressures and influences. And that's why a fence is necessary. Man is vulnerable both as a physical being and as a spiritual personality. Vulnerability of man is a very important principle from a theological viewpoint. We Jews believe that man is judged by his maker. The concept of mishpat u'tzedakah is a central one in our thinking. Man is judged when, how often, how frequently, we have diverse opinions. Once a year, or according to one opinion, every day, but man is judged by his maker. And woe to man if he is found wanting. If man is judged, the question rises, how can he win? How can he be at peace? Eliphaz already asked this question. Ha'enish melekai yitzdok? Shall mortal man be judged before God? He may say yita gorer? Shall a man be pure before his maker? How can men win the trial? Be pronounced innocent. The rescue for man, the rescue of man is due to his vulnerability. Man is acquitted by his maker because man is vulnerable. The vulnerability of man is a factor which mitigates the harshness of God's judgment. Yes, man is a sinner. Question is, why does he sin? Why did man listen to the serpent? Why does he violate the moral law? The answer is, because man has been and still is vulnerable, exposed to all kinds of pressures. He is easily persuaded, indeed brainwashed, and quickly defeated. At times, he is challenged by an intellectual, agnostic society, as it is too far of the present. At another time, he is intoxicated with hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure. Quite often, he is pulled by political social movements which appear under the disguise of redeemers. in a word, the environment scoffs at his commitments and promises. He sins because he's a weakling, because fate defeated him. Some are saints and righteous people because they were born into a home of saintliness and righteousness. Some are sinners because we are born into a house of atheism and agnosticism. Should the wicked be found guilty? Why is he wicked? Because he is vulnerable to external pressures and yields easily. And the answer is no. He is not guilty. And that's how man wills when he stands before the Almighty, before the heavenly bar of justice. And how beautifully the Mishneh in Yume says, Shnei Siri Yema Kippurim Shoven Bemare Bekemo Bedomin Venukochim Kechet. The two Sirim or the two he-goats of Yom Kippur should be alike in appearance, alike in size, and alike in value, and have been bought at the same time. If the space Sirim, if the two Sirim are alike, exactly like identical beings, why should one be consecrated to the Almighty and the second one to Azazel, provided the discrepancy as to their destinies? The answer is obvious. What's the answer? What's the answer? Two lots were cast over them. One lot had the letters Lashay. The second lot, on the second lot, the letters Lazozel were engraved. And the mere accidental performance was by the archpriest, by the king of Israel, by placing blindly one lot upon one Seir and another lot upon the other Seir, determined their future. The Nesanari in our Shnei Asirim Girolis, Girolechot Ladishem, the Girolechot Lazazel. The secret of atonement is hidden in the ceremonial casting of the lots. Because man sins under duress and constraint, under the pressure of hostile accidents, he is found not guilty, innocent, before the bar of justice. And what is Purim? What is the word semantics of the word Purim? If not what? If not just casting of a lot, just giral, these unreasonable, absurd accident which brought about the edict by Ahasuerus. Now let me ask you one question. Is it possible? Is there something accidental, absurd in nature or in history? Do we have the right to speak about Geron or about Mazel? I mean, we know what the opinion of the ancient Greeks was. They answered the question in the positive. They looked upon faith as upon something absurd, unalterable and ruthless, that at best is indifferent to the aspirations of man. And the clash between man and faith, between intelligence and inert matter, is, in their view, the source of human tragedy. Man is always the loser, matter is the winner. However, the Hadith, even though it knew of and tried to understand catastrophic events that viciously destroy man, his dreams and hopes, the Hadith could not accept the existence of something unreasonable in human life. Jihadis, even though she herself told us this story, of the whirlwind which came from across the wilderness, smote the four corners of the house, killing everybody, even though she herself told us this story, could not look upon the whirlwind, or the great wind, as an absurd accident. According to Hadith, there are no accidents in being. The Hadith maintains that events which we call unreasonable and which we classify under the rubric of accident or fate belong to a higher divine order into which man has not been initiated. While man was granted the opportunity to gain some insight in the ordinary scientific logic which deals with regular events, he was denied the privilege of understanding the so-called Giral, Giral events which impress us as being irregular, incoherent happenings. Men cannot grasp the relationship between the individual and its environment, and its environment. However, even the most unreasonable event may begin to reveal structural patterns in retrospection. Retrospection sheds a light upon many enigmatic, allegedly unreasonable events when men views those events in the context of experiences which follow them, the freakish event may appear to be a regular one. In hindsight, many events become understandable. V'royo ba'aveir kvedi v'samticho b'nitra satsur. While God passes by, while the event takes place, while the historical drama is being unfolded, one cannot understand what is happening. However, after God's passing by, in retrospective meditation, in glancing backwards, you may begin to see God's back or the contours of reasonableness in an event which you consider and classify as absurd and unreasonable. If this be true, then it is legitimate to ask a question about the Purim experience. to ask the question, why was the Purim experience necessary at all? Of course, we are asking, let's say, in humility, because in general the question why should not be addressed to the Almighty. I would rather suggest, instead of why, to ask, what is the message that the Purim experience is trying to, the Purim experience is formulated for the Jews. What is it? In context of our lecture, we may ask, what did the Purim experience achieve, basically? It's very strange. Chazal or rabbis ascribed great significance to the Purim experience. The latter has precipitated, according to their opinion, the reaffirmation of the covenant, or the confirmation of the old commitment, Nasser and Ishmael. Roma Robe of Pekin, Hoda Kablu, Benea Hashverish, Mersibu Kimu Vikibu Ayudim, Kimu Mashikibu Tor. And even the text of the Megillah itself bears witness to the great impact that the experience had on the Jewish people. The Divri Yemei Apurim Yavam Etech Ayudim Vizichom Yosef Mizarom, that these days of Purim should not fail from among the Jews, nor the memorial of them perish from their seed. And the verse is related not only to the observance of Purim as a day of feasting and joy, but to the unique message contained in the experience of Purim. Apparently, the Almighty wanted the Jews to derive several very important conclusions from the Purim experience. And indeed, the Jews did arrive such conclusions from the whole Purim drama, which they said reflected vulnerability of the Jew, and at first glance, complete absurdity and nonsense. The way Ahasuerus acted, the way many actors in that drama acted. Conclusion number one. The Jews discovered, and they keep on discovering, in every generation, that Kol Adam Kezev, in plain English, means that man is a liar. However, it's not a question of men being a liar or men being truthful. Something more serious is involved. The Jews have discovered that man goes from time to time, beset, turns into a monster, and replaces his divine personality with a satanic personality. In other words, man is capable of personifying total evil. This discovery was an agonizing, traumatic experience for the Jews in Persia, and since then it has been an agonizing, difficult experience for Jews in all countries of the world. Why? The Jew believed, and still believes, that man was created in the image of God. Hence there is a divine spark in man, in every man, not excluding the habitual sinner or criminal. Deep down, the Jew maintained and is still maintaining there is something good in every man, but even in the sinner. The Jew believed,
they still believe the man. After all, the whole concept of Tshuva, the possibility of Tshuva, and the expectation that mankind will finally, come back to the Almighty, is based upon that principle, that there is something intrinsically good in man. And the Jew in Persia, who encountered Haman, and the German Jew in Germany and other countries, European countries, encountered Hitler. And American Jews who encounter from time to time, enemies, fiends, discover that man can incarnate total evil. And always the awakening is a good one. Apparently, Haman proved to them that there is an alternative to being divine. And that alternative consists in being Satan. In other words, the Jew in Persia met whom? We have a good word for that. Whom? Amalek. Amalek. We, after all, we read in the Parsha Zohar every year. As a matter of fact, we read four texts pertaining to Amalek. We read last chapter of the text, Aftiseitzei. We read Ampurim, Vayov Amalek, Ve'elochem Be'Yisrael. We read the Aftereach of Shmuel and Shaul. And we read also what we read. The Megillah. Megillah is death of Amalek. Who is Amalek? A man who personifies total evil. To whom immorality becomes a norm. Who is Amalek? Of course, it was a wandering Bedouin tribe, most probably. Yes. But the passage is quite serious when it says, Milchomo la v'shem ba'amalek midir dor. God has declared an eternal war on Amalek throughout the generations. I would say it would be below the dignity of God to declare eternal war on a Bedouin tribe. And Amalek will only be defeated only at the commencement of the Messianic era. No one will be capable of defeating Amalek. The final defeat of Amalek will take place when the King Messiah will arrive. So who is Amalek? It isn't just a Bedouin tribe. It's not a race. Nor is it a group, a nationality. It is man who went berserk, man who incarnates total evil, man Satan. He can either be created in the image of God or in the image of Satan. Man demon is Amalek. I once heard from my father, in the name of my grandfather, that any people, or any group of people, who, is committed to one purpose, to destroy the Jewish people, is to be classed, such a group is to be classified as Amalek. If one writes on its banner, L'chu v'nachride migoi v'leizocher shem Yisrael eit bo'elam bo'oretz, excuse me, acquires the status of Amalek, And the commandment of Moche Kimche is applicable to him or to them. And quite often Amalek or man Satan succeed in his attempt to gain power and to cause untold suffering to millions or hundreds of millions of people. I believe it's our generation. I'm not speaking of most of you are young, but I'm speaking of people who are as old as I am. Our generation encountered a few of them. There's no doubt about it that Hitler was a Amalek, no doubt about it. I'm speaking now in halachical terms. Hitler and his entourage and company. There is no doubt that Stalin had the status of a Amalek, or the incarnation of total evil. I have doubts about the generous Mr. Leonid Brezhnev. And about Mao Zedong, I don't know, but I have serious doubts about it. Now that I'm concerned over Confucius and Beethoven, but I don't know. Intuitively I feel that there is incarnation of evil, of total evil. This is one discovery the Jew made due to the incident of the Purim drama. Something else was discovered by the Jew. A second discovery the Jew made. Namely, Amalek, man Satan, hates everybody. Because the dictionary that you see Satan will say, what does it say? Well, how do they describe Satan? The enemy of man, in general. Or the adversary of man. This is Satan. Hates everybody. He enjoys causing misery and injury to all men. All are alike. Yet Satan, man Satan, or Amalek, is particularly preoccupied with the Jew. It's something irrational. It's something crazy, absurd, mad. But he is preoccupied with the Jew. He hates the Jew more than anybody else. And in causing suffering and pain to the Jew, he finds his greatest delight. And, let me tell you, and it doesn't matter what Amalek represents, what the Satan represents. Sometimes the Satan represents the socio-economic, socio-political program of the Satan is completely irrelevant in that. Sometimes the Satan represents progress. He is progressive. Sometimes he's reactionary. Sometimes he's agnostic secular. And sometimes he's religious clerical. The hate of the Jew is the central preoccupation of Amalek, regardless of his social, political, and economic commitments. As I said before, it was a rude awakening. The Jew discovered, and the Jew keeps on discovering, something which is quite simple. The Jew in Persia discovered for the first time that there is somebody who hates them. No other nation can brag about it. You know, if there is somebody who hates America, who hates Germany, who hates France, no. And if there is hatred, it is due to war, to a clash of interests, to competition,
But the Jew can despite say there is somebody in this world. Whether this somebody is one individual or this somebody is a million or 60 million people. It's completely, or 800 million people or 700 million people. It's completely irrelevant. But there is somebody who hates me. And the hate of the Jew can erupt like a volcano at any time. The mere existence of the Jew irritates Amalek. The mere presence of the Jew provokes the wrath. It's completely absurd. It's unreasonable. It's mad. But it is a reality. And somehow the Jews get entangled in events which lie completely outside of their concern. You all know the story of the biblical ram, which Abraham caught and sacrificed instead of Isaac. What was the ram? The ram was caught in the thicket by his horns. It's symbolic of the Jew. The Jew is always caught in the thicket of events which are completely unrelated to him, to which he has no relationship. There is always between two great empires, and he has to cast his, so to say, his lot with the more distant one. They found out that to hate the Jew, hate of the Jew, is capable of being translated into violence of apocalyptic proportions, into a satanic attempt of total destruction. And let me tell you, I mean, it's not only Hitler came up with this idea. The idea, I mean, they actually. Priority should be given to Haman. I mean, he was the first one. If you hate the Jews, so destroy him, all right? Or by suffering. Since he is, but Haman also, the Chorzeinen Shogali, Bishosh Alshka, and Rey Mordechai Yudi Yeshi Bishar Amalek. He irritates, the presence of Mordechai irritated Haman. He couldn't stand him. So since he couldn't stand him, So the best solution to the problem was to execute him, to hang him. For instance, let's not fool ourselves. The problem of Eretz Israel, the state of Israel, is not a problem only of existence of a political institution like state. Simply, our enemies want simply to destroy not only the state as a political institution, but the issue as well. Third, he made a third discovery, the Jew, in Persia, and the German Jews made it in Germany, and every Jew makes this discovery in his respective country. The hostility toward the Jew by Amalek, by man Satan, is not directed exclusively against the religious Jew, who is conspicuous in his being different and unique. The hate embraces religious as well as agnostic Jews, the nationalist Jew as well as the assimilationist Jew.